We are back with Alan Guth. We are at MIT, Bill Russell and I. We were talking about mathematics, and I must say, as we headed into this conversation, I was thinking, you know, people could just say, oh, groan, we're going to talk with a physicist who talks about 10 to the minus 23 seconds. Not groan at all. You're talking about the elegance of all that is, aren't you?
Well, we hope so. I mean, inflation really is a spectacular theory, if it's right. It really does explain the origin of essentially all of the matter and energy and the contents of the universe.
Can you do inflation in 25 words or fewer?
35
words or fewer?
Something like that.
Not counting.
Four paragraphs.
Okay. Inflation is based on an observation that comes out of ideas in particle theory. Particle theory really was my background, not cosmology. I got into cosmology sort of through the back door. But it turns out that modern particle theories predict that there should actually be a kind of matter which turns gravity on its head and creates a gravitational repulsion instead of a gravitational attraction. And inflation is basically the hypothesis that that's how the universe started, in this peculiar form of matter, with the gravitational repulsion being the driving force behind the Big Bang. And while the early universe would have undergone this colossal expansion being driven by the repulsive gravity, matter would actually be created as the space expanded. And essentially all of the matter that we see today would have resulted from that early phase. I should confess that inflation does not by itself explain the actual origin of the universe. It starts with a little bit of stuff already present. But it gets you back to a small enough amount of stuff so that one can then imagine other mechanisms and perhaps even explain how it all really began.
And to put this in scale, my recollection is to say that the available universe today could essentially be fit into something the size of a protein?
Well, that's right. If the inflationary theory is right, at the time when inflation started, the entire observed universe that we see today would have been compressed to a size far smaller than the size of a proton.
Yeah. This is also, you know, when you talk about cosmology and say, you know, oh, it's physics and it's math and how boring and dull, we're also talking about metaphysics, of which cosmology is a branch, and it is one of the earliest things that thinkers started thinking about. Where did we come from?
That's right.
And what you have tried to do in the long tradition, particularly starting with the Enlightenment, but really predating that, going back to the Greeks and presumably before that, is to try to come up with, how to say, scientific answers for that rather than mythological explanations for that. And you seem to be doing a pretty good job.
Is that how you see it?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, it is certainly a fact that the basic questions of cosmology, the ones that are the most fascinating, are the same questions that are discussed in Genesis. Needless to say, cosmologists try to approach things in a more detailed way than the Book of Genesis does. And the detailed questions that we ask and try to test involve things that you'd never find in Genesis. But nonetheless, the exciting questions, the ones that we're really hoping to answer, are the same ones.
I'm going to go to a footnote from the inflationary universe, because it's funny. Who would have thought that a book about the beginnings of the universe would be funny? You do a limerick from, do you pronounce it Gamow?
To tell you the truth, your guess is as good as mine.
Okay,
it's
well,
either that
this
or
is
Gamow.
A very famous physicist, okay? Gamow. There was a young fellow from Trinity who took the square root of infinity. You did this. It's your book. But the number of digits gave him the fidgets. He dropped from math and took up divinity. Isn't that what you're talking about? Isn't that the temptation, is to either be able to look at it and put numbers around it and observe, or to just say, I'm going to make this theology? Or am I too binary there?
Well, you're probably right. I like to think that I'm staying on the numerical side of this issue, but it certainly is true. It's the same kind of issues that are discussed in theology.
John Holland talks about metaphor and how important it is in the development of scientific theories, new scientific theories, building on perceptions and proceeding by analogy, metaphor, pick your favorite, but reaching back to an established body of understanding and then somehow or other mapping that onto a new set of circumstances. Is that a fair representation of what you were doing 20 years ago?
Hmm.
Could be the
hard
answer
to say.
Is no.
Hard to say.
Or you could pass on that.
What were you doing 20 years ago?
I could tell you that in my own words. I really did, as I mentioned earlier, get kind of dragged into cosmology through the back door, and I really was dragged into it. A friend of mine, Henry Tai, got interested in these grand unified theories, which were then quite new. At this time, he and I were both postdocs at Cornell.
A nomadic tribe.
A nomadic tribe, that's right. Postdocs were then and still are a nomadic tribe. So he came up to me one day and asked me if I knew whether or not these grand unified theories would predict the existence of particles called magnetic monopoles. A magnetic monopole is a particle which has a net north or a net south magnetic charge, unlike an ordinary magnet, which always has both. Ordinary magnets are what are called dipoles. So he asked me this because I had previously worked on magnetic monopoles as sort of abstract, conceivable theoretical entities, but I didn't know anything about grand unified theories. So he had to explain to me what these grand unified theories were about, and then I knew enough about magnetic monopoles to know the answer to his question. The answer was, yeah, grand unified theories do predict that magnetic monopoles should exist, but they'd be outrageously heavy. They would weigh about 10 to the 16 times as much as a proton. So from a particle physics point of view, that makes them uninteresting because you can only see what you can actually produce in accelerators. And if the mass is too high to produce it, you just never, ever see it. So I told him to forget it. But he immediately came back and said, well, why don't we try to figure out how many of them would have been produced in the Big Bang? At the time, it sounded to me like a thoroughly crazy idea because I didn't think we knew very much about the Big Bang, and I certainly didn't know very much about grand unified theories. So it didn't seem to me to be a great idea to put together these two areas of ignorance in hopes that you'd find something enlightening. But he kept nagging me. And then, in terms of my own thinking, what was certainly very important was Steve Weinberg, author of The First 3 Minutes and now a Nobel Prize winner. I think this was just a little bit before he won the Nobel Prize. But certainly at that time, he was an extraordinarily respected physicist, visited Cornell and gave a series of lectures about applications of grand unified theories to cosmology. So then I started to scratch my head and say, well, if Weinberg can think that this stuff makes sense, maybe it does make sense. So at that point...
So one crazy theory would allow for some more crazy theories?
That's right. It's contagious. So at that point, I gave in to Henry, and we started working together on the issue of how many of these magnetic monopoles would be produced in the Big Bang if grand unified theories were right. We soon came to the tentative conclusion that it looked like far too many of these monopoles would be produced, that the universe would just be swimming with them if these two theories were both right.
Too many by observation?
Too many from several points of view.
Theoretical standpoint.
One is observation, that is, none have been seen, and if the universe was swimming with them, you'd think you would see some. But it also turns out that these magnetic monopoles, because they're so extraordinarily heavy, the way they would show up first is that they would radically alter the total mass density of the universe. And that would radically change the rate at which the universe evolved. So actually the clearest way to say the conclusion is that if there were as many magnetic monopoles as Henry and I were calculating, the universe would only be about 10,000 years old. So it would only take 10,000 years for the universe to slow down to the expansion rate that we now measure if there was such a tremendous mass of monopoles causing it to slow down. Well, we knew the universe was older than 10,000 years.
So you had to chuck that one.
So we had to chuck that one. Now, in terms of what was going on, meanwhile, somebody else, someone named John Preskill, who at that time actually was a graduate student at Harvard working with Steve Weinberg, was working on the same topic and understood it, I think, better than we did, sooner than we did, and published the definitive paper concluding that grand unified theories plus standard cosmology leads to a tremendous glut of magnetic monopoles, far more than you could tolerate existing in the universe. So then Henry and I, having been scooped, scratched our heads and asked ourselves, what do we do next? And we realized that the sensible next question to ask is there some way of changing standard cosmology or grand unified theories in a way that might make them consistent with each other.
I'm going to interrupt and let you pick up that thought when we come back, because obviously we figured out what you were not going to do when you got scooped. Let's see what you did do when you came back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with Alan H. Guth. Please stay with us.